Welcome back to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Well, we finally got some rain in the southeastern part of the state, which we really needed, but now I notice that my weeds are growing like crazy. I guess we wouldn't be gardeners if we didn't have something to complain about. But whatever your problems are, we have a guest who can help. Lisa Johnson is back with us. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. And we're going to start off by talking about tomatoes. But whatever you have on your mind, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email, and that's to talk@wpr.org. Lisa, so good to have you back.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you.
You bet. So you said you got some questions about tomatoes not ripening. Was that what you wanted were saying when you emailed me?
Yeah, I have. And you can probably blame the hot weather on that. Tomatoes are native to South America, but in mountainous and coastal areas. So they actually ripen best between about 68 and 77 or so degrees Fahrenheit. And of course, we don't normally get those kinds of temperatures here in the middle of the summer. But the farther away from that top of the scale 77 that we get, the less easy it is for them to ripen. They're in a group of fruits that are called climacteric, and they keep that green pigment until they get mature. And then when they get mature, they start to ripen. And that's partly affected by temperature, but also the production of ethylene gas, which is a plant hormone that causes plants to ripen. And that gas is inhibited when temperatures are above 85, so that slows ripening. But also the pigments lycopene and carotene, which give, you know, a traditional tomato its color, those also are inhibited or totally eliminated when we get to 85 or over. So if it seems like your tomatoes are in slow motion ripening, that might be what the issue is. It's just too darn hot.
Well, that makes sense. So we can expect them to start ripening as soon as the temps start cooling down.
Yeah, which they have started, so yay.
Yay. I think we all appreciate that, along with the tomatoes. So that's great. So in that same vein, have you noticed that the tomatoes are having any disease problems at this point?
Oh, tomatoes are kind of the poster child for plant disease, I'm sure.
True.
Brian Buttleton would say. There are a lot of fungal diseases that they are susceptible to, particularly some of the fungal problems like septoria and early blight and the much dreaded and lethal late blight. Haven't heard that late blight is in Wisconsin yet this year, but certainly early blight and septoria that cause the leaves to spot and then fall off and so on. And then there's, of course, blossom end rot, which is not a disease, but a physical disorder that's caused by a shortage of calcium in the developing fruit, not necessarily the soil, but in the fruit.
Mm-hmm. And is that usually something that watering on a general, an even scale will help?
Yes, exactly. Calcium is taken up by the soil in the water stream. And so if that gets interrupted, if you don't water consistently, you go out of town, nobody waters, your plant gets really dry, then that interrupts that calcium flow. And calcium is really important in cell walls in developing fruits. And if you don't have it, well, those walls start to disintegrate, basically, and then you get that big ugly brown spot on the bottom of your fruit. And that can also happen with peppers. They're in the same family, and also with eggplant.
Ah, okay. One more tomato question before we go to the phones. I always hear so many different things about pruning tomatoes. What is your take on that?
So I co-authored a fact sheet on it. That you can find at the Wisconsin Horticulture website, which is hort.extension.wisc.edu. If you just do an internet search for Wisconsin Horticulture, it should come up, and then type tomato in the search bar, and that should come up. So with the pruning, tomatoes make a little sucker in the area between the axil and the, well, in the axil area. So that's between the stem and where the leaf stalk attaches. So that area is called the axil. And a sucker will come out of that. And suckers are just more stems of tomatoes, but these in particular, especially the ones below the first fruit cluster, tend to actually be more leafy and take energy away from the plant. So we usually recommend that you remove any suckers that are below the first flower slash fruit cluster. And if your tomato happens to be one of those that's particularly congested in its growth habit, and you want to increase the airflow, that's another thing to do, is to hunt out any other developing suckers and pinch them out where they start. Okay. And there's usually one that's at the very base of the plant as well, and that one should go.
Okay, definitely. Excellent. Thank you for clearing that up for us. We appreciate it, Lisa. All right, let's go to those phones. Kathy and Fontana, go right ahead with your question.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I'm just curious why we can't find any patty pan squash and haven't been able to for the last couple of years.
Huh. This is the first I've heard of that. I could theorize that maybe there have been some crop failures with the seed production. Of course, there are a lot of different companies that might produce patty pan, but sometimes that is something that happens, or that several companies have issues with producing the seed.
Kathy, are you looking for the seed or are you looking for seedlings?
I'm looking for the actual vegetable at a farm stand.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. I know they aren't always as prevalent to begin with as things like tomatoes, but if there is a particular market that you frequent, I would ask the plant seller what's up, and it may be that they had a crop failure or that a rabbit went through and got all of their plants or something like that.
Or maybe it's just not as popular as it used to be. And maybe they're not selling it.
Yeah, they decided to. Yeah, that could happen too.
Yeah. If any, and you're in Fontana, so anybody up in the Fontana area that knows where Kathy can get some patty pan, give us a call or send an email. One of the two will help her out. So good luck, Kathy. Paul in Darlington, go right ahead with your question.
Yeah, I was wondering, seemed to have an explosion of ground squirrels this year. I've planted green beans and peas 3 times, and they just keep eating them off on me, and along with other vegetables. Just wondering what type of suggestions you have. I know other farmers in the area are having trouble with them as well. One person, in fact, lost 50% of her beet crops to ground squirrels.
Goodness. Wow. Oh, that's so rude. Yeah. So, I mean, for home gardeners, you can do things like put up bird netting. But for farm scale, boy, that is really difficult. We do have a publication at the Wisconsin Horticulture site on ground squirrels. And there may be some suggestions that you can find there. Ground squirrels, you know, like most other mammals, tend to have boom and bust cycles. And when conditions are right, that you get For example, if there was an oak mast year and a whole bunch of acorns were produced or some other food source was readily available, heck, the cicadas a couple of years ago, there are so many critters that eat cicadas, and that usually then causes a population boom, which is then followed by a bust. So I will hope that we will get a bust for next year, which doesn't help you very much this year.
No.
But there are some, you know, traps and so on that you can find out about in that publication.
And Paul, Scott Craven, and I can't remember if it was Melinda Myers or somebody else, has recommended Plants Skid. That's SKYDD, which is organic, and I guess it's Swedish. That's where the spelling comes in. You have to reapply it, but they recommend it and say it really helps. But you know, those animals get used to stuff, and then they're like, huh, whatever. But yeah. you could try it and see if it'll help. So good luck. I noticed myself that my rabbits have been particularly nasty this year eating stuff because of the drought that we had in our area. There was no grass, so they were looking for anything to eat. So
yeah. The turkeys have been doing that too at my mom's house, just ravaging the ornamental plants along with the vegetables.
Yep, exactly. So, okay, we're talking to Lisa Johnson today. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. If you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234, and you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So we've got some questions here. Anna emailed. She said approximately 2 weeks ago, she noticed squash beetles on her pumpkin vines, and after trying various methods of exterminating them and the eggs, she finally resorted to stomping them, squishing them, and pruning off the leaves with the eggs. Since that time, she has not noticed any other squash beetles returning to the plant, but she is wondering, how did the squash beetle even find her plant to begin with, and how could she avoid this infestation in the future?
Oh, boy, if I could answer that one definitively, I'd be a wealthy person. So the squash bugs overwinter as adults. So they, if your neighbor grows, you know, squash, either winter or summer squash, or other cucurbitaceae type crops, and they didn't clean up their garden very well last year, the squash bugs can overwinter in leaf litter, garden litter, and a little bit into the soil, you know, crevices and so on. It's really hard to get rid of all of them. But if they get a foothold somewhere, then it's easier for them to find your plants. And insects are really good at sensing the type of crop that they need for survival. And the adults can fly, so that may be how they found it. If somebody else in the neighborhood has them, then they flew in and found yours. And I think mechanical removal, you know, squishing the eggs, I think that's a great organic technique. If you don't have, you know, miles of squash plants that you need to tend to, that's a fine way to deal with it.
I think my neighbors wonder about my sanity sometimes when I'm out there squishing Japanese beetles. I have a rose bush out in front. It gets me so angry. You know, it's a good way to get your stress out.
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, good luck, Anna. Now, since she removed all of these, her chances of getting them back next spring or summer are probably going to be less because she's...
Hopefully. Yeah. It depends, you know, again, if the neighbor has a bunch of them, anybody in the area, then they can fly in. Mm-hmm. But certainly helping to get them out of your immediate area is going to help for sure. Yeah, you want to make sure they don't get overwinter in your yard.
Okay, we've got a Vern called, couldn't stay with us, but was wondering, should you check your soil for lead, arsenic, and mercury?
Certainly, if you have a concern, like if you live in an older house where lead paint has been used, or if you are putting in a new vegetable garden and there are concerns, I'll give a little story here. In Door County, for example, where fruit trees have been grown for a long, long time, they used to use arsenic as an insecticide. So a lot of the soils end up being just loaded with it, which is really unfortunate because it's, you can't really remediate that very easily. But yeah, lead paint is typically the biggest concern. If you were gardening on something like an old gas station site or next to a gas station site, it would certainly be worth that. The Wisconsin Department of Hygiene does test for those types of things. And the UW Soils Lab, I believe they also test for lead, but I'm not sure about arsenic and mercury.
So when you get your soil tested so you kind of, know what you're dealing with, can you ask for those?
Yeah, those are a special test.
Okay.
That adds a bit of a cost onto the normal testing. Mm-hmm. Normal soil testing will tell you the alkalinity and acidity of the soil. That's the pH. It'll tell you the organic matter, which is a kind of stand-in for how much nitrogen you have. And it'll tell you phosphorus and potassium. And those three nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, are the macronutrients that plants need in the largest concentrations. So those are the ones that are in a typical basic soil test. Now, if you want the secondary macronutrients, calcium and sulfur, you can get further testing for that too.
Okay. John from Junction City called but couldn't stay with us. He's dealing with blossom end rot. Would eggshells help?
I get that question a lot. And if you have an actual calcium deficiency, there are better and faster and safer sources than eggshells. One thing you do have to worry about with eggshells is potential salmonella. So I don't usually recommend them. It's also pretty slow to make any difference. And again, with blossom end rot, it quite possibly may be that it's not calcium in your soil that's lacking. It's just the uptake of the calcium that's the problem because of inconsistent watering. Now, heirloom tomatoes are particularly sensitive and often are culprits when you're looking for crops that have blossom end rot. There's also a calcium spray that you can use to put on developing fruits, but I think the easiest and best thing to do, unless you have a soil test that says you have a calcium deficiency, is to just water consistently.
Sure, yeah.
Especially in pots or raised beds.
Oh, yeah. Makes total sense. Susan in Appleton, go right ahead with your question.
Hi. I've noticed that I've had an increase in moss in my perennial gardens, and things don't seem to grow where the moss grows. Do I need to remove that?
Some people actually like moss gardens, and
I do
attempt to grow the moss. But moss typically is going to grow in areas that don't have the greatest drainage. The soil may be somewhat acidic. So that's what you often will see in terms of areas that moss will grow. If you want to grow something else in the area where you have moss, I would try adding some organic matter and trying to increase the drainage in that area by adding the organic matter and mixing it in real good.
Okay, good luck, Susan, or embrace moss.
Yeah, it is a kind of a cool look. I've seen some really attractive moss gardens.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I'm really hoping to develop a nice moss garden, you know, in my spare time. Thanks for the call. Susan in Madison emailed us. She has a raised garden box that's 3 feet high. It's a fresh raised garden type soil was added this... So fresh raised garden type soil was added this spring. Her green beans are leafy and climbing up the trellis, but so far no flowers have appeared, so no beans are forthcoming. Seeds have been in the soil for 2.5 months. She does water when dry. What is the problem with no blossoms? The snow peas in front of the beans have finished their production, and the pepper and eggplant in the same box are prolific this year.
Huh. That is really interesting. I'm assuming that the plant, did she say it had not flowered?
Yeah, no flowers.
No flowers. I'm wondering what kind of beans these are. She said they've been in the ground for 2.5 months. So it's now August, July, June. Okay, so they were planted in plenty of time.
Yeah, she said they're leafy and climbing up the wire trellis, but just no flowers.
Yeah. I have noticed that mine have been flowering less this year, too, and it could possibly be temperature related, that perhaps it's interfering with the initiation of the flowers. That's the only thing I can think of.
Mm-hmm. So maybe just...
other crops are prospering there, and especially the peas, which that would have been earlier in the year, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Before the super hot weather hit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've had flowers aboard on my peppers, fewer flowers than normal on the beans. Certainly the tomato problem I've experienced as well. So I think we are seeing some issues from that. Hopefully now that it's a little bit more moderate in terms of temperature, maybe we'll start to see some more flower production.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't think that it would be, you know, too much nitrogen if other plants in the bed are behaving normally.
Yeah. Now, if she does get flowers in, you know, maybe it happens next week like magic. Is there still time for the green beans to
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Our fall goes for so long now as well that you can produce beans well into the end of, you know, September very easily.
Okay. So all hope is not lost. So maybe.
Yeah.
and what about actually replanting? I mean, is that even?
It's getting a little late for that, but you could certainly try.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the great things about beans is that they are pretty quick to reproduce.
Right.
So you can always do succession planting in the spring. You know, in the Madison area, I usually recommend waiting until about Memorial Day. And then if you wanted to plant another crop 2 weeks later, you could do that. And possibly even 2 weeks after that. I think, like I say, it's probably getting a little late, but heck, it wouldn't hurt to try.
Take out part of them, put a few more in just to see what happens.
Yeah, see if that does anything for
you. I mean, these days, you know, summer lasts into October, so you never can tell. So we are talking with Lisa Johnson. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. If you have questions for her, we have open phone lines. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or, of course, you can send an email, and that is talk@wpr.org. We'll be back in just a sec. Thank you. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for listening today. Join us again next week, and we're going to talk about daylilies with a couple of experts from the Wisconsin Daylily Society. Right now, we're taking your generalized gardening questions. But before that, we wanted to talk a little bit about watering woody plants when it is a drought going on. So even though we got a little water down here, I know in the northern part of the state, they're still hoping for some more rain. Lisa, what's your best advice on watering those woody plants?
Sure. Well, most plants, woody or herbaceous, we usually recommend an inch a week. Now, I know particularly with the weather being as unpredictable as it tends to be these days, we tend to get more large dumps of rain than we tend to get nice, even applications of rain from Mother Nature. So when Mother Nature does not provide, it's up to us. Now, it isn't that plants can't stand to be dry at all, but when we have 3 weeks without rain, that's really stressful, even on large trees. Particularly oaks are susceptible to getting two-line chestnut borer when they have been stressed by drought, by spongy moth, et cetera. And we do worry, too, about the newly planted trees that have been planted within the last 3 years. Those actually need more in many textures of soil. Usually about 2 inches of water a week would be recommended. And for those established trees, when we have those three-week stretches without water, the ideal amount that you'd want to apply is 10 gallons per caliper inch. Now, what does that mean? the caliper of the tree is the diameter, and that's usually measured at 4.5 feet up from the base of the trunk. And so you get yourself a measuring tape and you measure around. If it's a 5-inch caliper tree and we want 10 gallons of water for every 5 inches, then, you know, you have your answer there.
That's a lot of math, Lisa.
Yeah, well, it's actually, you can do this pretty easily. You get yourself a couple of inexpensive 5-gallon buckets. You drill a few holes in the bottom so that water can come out slowly. You fill them up, you put them on each side of the trunk, and after you've done your math, then you just move those around. You want to start close to the trunk and move out towards the end of the drip line. We used to say start at the drip line, but we're kind of saying now to move out from the trunk.
That's a really great idea, because then, I know when I water something and I'm standing there with a hose, I'm like, well, the water's starting to run off. So what am I supposed
exactly.
to do? Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've even, like, on new trees, there is a tool called a Ross root feeder that you can screw onto the end of your hose, and it's got a big pokey end that has it's perforated with holes, mm-hmm. and you can, as long as you don't blast the water, you can stab holes in the ground around the plant and water it that way. Or sometimes I've dug some shallow holes around the plant so that the water will pool there. I'm often aided in this with turkeys, unfortunately. They like to dig cooling beds for themselves. Which can be a problem if there's a plant in the way. Just a few shallow holes, and that will help the water to soak in rather than run off.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phone. We have Leland in Stoughton who has a question for you. Go ahead, Leland.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just checking to see what the risk factors are, if any, from using rainwater in a rain barrel collected off an asphalt roof. And then the other would be what your recommendations are to have a successful like those small cherry tomatoes planted in a 5-gallon bucket. I never seem to have success. The leaves always turn yellow when I have a small yield.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start with the tomato question, I guess. What type of soil are you using in your bucket?
I generally use some compost and it's just like a potting soil.
Okay, so bagged compost, I assume.
Actually, I get it from our town. We have a free compost for using the dump out there.
Okay. I would stop that, first of all, and I would get bagged compost. The reason for that is because you don't know the source of the compost from the city. They could have ground up black walnut in there. They can have trees that were diseased, and there are some diseases that you can get passed along in compost or wood chips. So I would use the bagged stuff. Second of all, I'm assuming that you've got holes, considerable holes in the bucket for drainage?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Do you have any in the sides about like 3 inches up from the base?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So drainage is not a problem. We'll knock that off our list. If we get the soil issue solved, I think that will help you. Now, when you say the leaves get yellow, do they get spots before they turn yellow?
Yes. And it happens usually this time of year.
Okay. That is probably one of the fungal diseases. It may be fungal disease that is soil borne. So again, controlling what your soil source is can help to eliminate some of that. I also usually will eliminate the bottom leaves on the plant so that if there is any splash up from the soil in the pot and there is any soil-borne disease in there, that it helps to reduce that. But to be honest, unfortunately, like I said, tomatoes are the poster child for disease, and you're usually going to get some level of disease. You can try and mitigate that by using resistant varieties and controlling your soil source and making sure you water at the base of the plant, but you probably will still get some level of disease. But I would try that with the soil first to see if that helps you out any.
And would that be affecting his yield, Lisa?
It certainly could. I mean, the more disease that you get, the less energy the tomato has to put into creating and maintaining fruits.
And then his question about using the rain off of the roof?
Yeah. So I don't recommend using that for vegetables. You can certainly use it for your non-fruit trees. You can use it for your shrubs, you can use it for your perennials, but we don't recommend it for vegetables because, as you noted, it does go over asphalt, and particularly if it's either a new roof or an old roof, you have more of a chance of some of those chemicals coming off into the rainwater, which I know is really unfortunate because we'd like to use that perfectly good water source, but it isn't a perfectly good water source if it's asphalt roof.
Okay, great. Thank you, Leland. Let's go on to Mouston now. Herb, go right ahead.
Yes, I try to grow my plants indoors for a month or two before putting them outside, vegetables. And I'm trying to find the perfect pot that would help me with air pruning or some type of process to stop the root bound dilemma we have growing so many plants inside. Thank you.
Sure. So the easiest thing actually to do is to start those plants a little bit later so that they don't get so big and be so root bound. I know that you're probably trying to hedge your bets and have a bigger plant to put out. But in most cases, if you did an experiment where you started some plants at the regular time, started the same type of plants a week or two later, I am pretty sure that the later started plants will not only do better, but they will catch up to and possibly surpass the larger plants. I don't know, unfortunately, of any magic pot. There may be something out there that encourages root pruning. It's probably expensive if there is such a critter out there. I mean, there are some like vented inserts that you can get to put in pots, but I think you're still going to get circling roots the longer they're in there. I mean, one thing you could do, I guess, is once the roots start to circle, is cut them off, you know, which is going to be a pain. You'll have to spend some time taking things out of the pots and cutting some of the circling roots off, which will encourage them to make more branching roots. So you could do that if you don't have a whole lot of vegetables, but I would just start them a little later.
Yeah, and I did do a quick Google search, and there are some things out there. I don't know what the cost or whatever, but you can try and see if there's anything you want to try on as far as air pruning goes. But and basically, air pruning, if you want to explain it, Lisa, what that is, so people, if they haven't heard about it.
Yeah, so if you have a pot that is vented on the sides, when the roots get to the edge there, and if they would try and grow through any of those vents, they would dry out and die along the edges because they don't have any media to be in. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very, very diligent about watering plants in those kinds of pots because it certainly allows plant roots to dry out a lot quicker.
Okay, thanks, Herb. Rita Lynn in Green Bay, you're next. Go ahead.
My daughter's cucumbers and squash are all putting out just male flowers. What's happening?
Yeah, that's unfortunately kind of a common thing. Usually you get males at the beginning of the production season. Then you will get males and females, and then it'll go back to males again. And unfortunately, this is another temperature thing as well, where you don't get as many female flowers initiated if the temperature's too hot and it's, you know, dry and so on. So that is probably it, depending on the type of cucurbit that you have and what its typical production season is. You know, most cucumbers are going to be well into their production cycle now, so they should be producing female flowers. I'm guessing that in a week or two, you probably will see female flowers being produced once the temperature is down for a little while.
So would she get much, I don't know what kind of squash she has, but we still have a few more months, so you should be able to get some. So
yeah.
Thank you, Rita Lynn. Appreciate it. Lulu in Milwaukee, go ahead with your question.
Oh, thank you so much for this public radio program. I have a two-part question. Number one is, with sunflowers that we plant in our gardens, do they give off some type of compound that suppresses other plants, such as tomatoes? That's number one. And number two, with black-eyed Susans, we know that they're very aggressive and kind of bullyish and take over. Is that because they are just aggressive, or is it because they also put out a compound that suppresses other plants?
Ooh, yeah. Well, I can tell you right now, the sunflowers are definitely bullies in my garden.
Well, sunflowers do have some allelopathy. They put out various chemicals that will cause or inhibit the growth of some other plants. I'm sure that there are some plants that are more of a problem in, you know, being able to deal with that than other plants. I'm not sure about the black-eyed Susan. They do tend to produce colonies because they produce or they reproduce by seed, but I'm not sure about those. It says mild allelopathic properties. Yeah, I've not heard that those have been much of a problem other than just being very prolific, but the sunflowers do mm-hmm. have allelopathy.
Okay, hopefully that answers your question, Lulu. Thanks for the call. And we've got some emails here. Anne in Wisconsin Dells says she's become acquainted with using bone char over the years since she regularly uses marrow bones in bone broth and as dog treats. She's been making her own, and after she's accumulated a sufficient amount, after drying, she just burns them in her fire pit, and after the char and ashes cool, she pounds them down into a coarse powder and adds it to her garden in the spring, and everything grows much better. Have you heard of doing that before, Lisa?
I have heard of biochar, but not bone char before. I imagine if, you know, it's got calcium and mm-hmm. phosphorus in it. So
is that like bone meal? Is that similar?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay, bone meal. Okay. But bone meal isn't burnt. It's just ground
up. Right.
Yeah. So the one thing I would wonder about is if there is calcium carbonate in that, and if there is, that you might be raising your pH. But other than that, calcium, phosphorus is going to be great for plants.
Mm-hmm. And obviously it's working for her. So thank you for sharing that with us. It sounds like a lot of work. I don't think I would do it, but good for her. I love it.
Using that material.
Yeah, for sure. Sue and Cable emailed us. She planted green beans, Kentucky Wonder Pole, about June 20th and is still waiting to see blossoms. So looks like we've got a trend here. The plants have climbed more than 6 feet. And when should she expect to see blossoms? So same problem we had earlier.
Does it say where the caller is from?
Cable.
Okay, so that's north.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably is about the right time for planting those. Down here in the south, we usually plant them around May 30th or the first week of June. June 20th, July 20th, I'd say probably a couple more weeks. Usually, once they are, you know, initiated, once the flowers are initiated, it doesn't take that long, but it can take a while, especially if, you know, I don't know what the temperatures have been like up there,
I think it's been hot in general.
Yeah. So I would think that you would be seeing them sometime soon here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like we said, you know, it seems that green beans are just not blooming yet. So Sumner emailed, he's harvested 30 Wisconsin 55 tomatoes to date, but he has 70. Apparently Sumner likes to count. they're still green. And he's wondering if he still has time for them to ripen.
Oh, they should. Yeah.
Yeah. Plenty of time.
If the temperatures moderate here, which they seem to be doing, if, you know, if we don't end up back in the 90s again.
Yeah.
I think things should turn around. You'll get mm-hmm. the ethylene gas and the lycopene and carotene produced, and you should.
Yeah. And remember, there's fried green tomatoes and other things right. you can do with them. So.
You know, you can also ripen green tomatoes in bags, because that will concentrate that ethylene gas. But it's not quite the same.
No, not quite.
Ripening them outside.
Yeah, exactly. We also wanted to, before we have to say goodbye here, you want to talk about shrinking your lawn, which, you know, I don't particularly like to mow the grass, so I'm all for it. So what ideas do you have for us?
So I'm encouraging people to plant more native plants that will support our insects that are the basis of the food web. Most of our breeding songbirds need insects, and particularly caterpillars, to feed their young. Their young can't eat berries and seeds and so on. There are some that can, but most species really need insects to feed their young. And if we don't have insects, then we don't have the birds. And this has been borne out with 3 billion breeding birds that have disappeared over the past like 20 years. And partly we can credit insecticides for doing that, but also loss of habitat. We have 45 million acres of lawn. It is the largest irrigated crop in the US. And we really need to start supporting our ecosystems because they support us.
And what is the best process for going about that? I mean, I'm sure, you know, it's a huge job to just say, okay, I'm just going to get rid of my lawn. That's a mm-hmm. that's a big undertaking. So what are some hints for just, you know, kind of just shrinking that down?
Yeah. So, I mean, start small. You don't need to replace your entire lawn or even half your lawn. Start small, and you can, what I would do is rake the grass first, and so that you'll have less of it. Ideally, you'd mow it first, then you would rake it. And then you could put cardboard down on top of it to kill it, and wait a few weeks. And then you can cut holes in the cardboard. I'd water the cardboard during that time to kind of soften it up a bit. But then you can either put soil on top of that cardboard and seed in the fall, or you can purchase plugs. That's the most economical way if you're going to cut holes instead and not seed. You cut your holes, you put your plugs in, and there you have it. The plants will kind of sit there for the rest of the season. The first year you don't always see very much, but they're putting down some massive roots, and next season you should start to get a reward from that. I would either, if you're going to use plugs, I would use some bark mulch just to begin with to keep weeds down.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty simple. I've been using the cardboard, and I really, really like it. It really helps cut down on the weeds. So,
yes.
Yeah. Give it a try. And like you said, small little area. See what happens. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Lisa, I can't believe an hour's gone by already.
Oh. Wow.
I know. It goes by so fast. So thank you. Thank you again for sharing your knowledge with us. And I'm sure we'll have you back in a few more months to do it once again. So thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. This has been Garden Talk. Lisa Johnson has been our guest. She's a UW horticulture educator for Dane County. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you to Jeff Robbins for being on the board with us, and for Claire Neipert for taking calls. I'm Jill Nadeau. We'll be back again next week, and we're going to talk about daylilies with the experts from the Wisconsin Daylily Society. Hope you can join us then. Have a wonderful weekend.